paper which was published around mid-year last year. It's called Solving the Optimal Trading Trajectory Problem Using a Quantum Annealer. And it was published by these guys from 1Qubit, which is a quantum computing software company based in Canada. They basically they have this partnership with D-Wave, and they basically run different types of problems on the D-Wave. So today we'll be talking about this financial problem and how they implemented on the D-Wave and what they observed basically. So this is the basic objective of my talk. The first I'll give a brief introduction to the portfolio optimization problem, which is basically the trading trajectory problem which was mentioned in the title. And after that I'll give a brief introduction to quantum annealing, and I'll illustrate how the portfolio optimization problem can be solved on the D-Wave. And then I'll look at the experimental results and describe the problems which the authors faced and the limitations of their work. And finally, we can think about whether it actually makes sense to implement execute real-life problems in the D-Wave based on the experimental results which the authors got. So in this slide, I'm going to talk about portfolio optimization. So portfolio optimization is basically the process of selecting the best portfolio out of multiple portfolio according to some objective. The objective is usually to minimize risk and maximize returns. So it's a constraint utility maximization problem, which means that there are various constraints on the problem. So for example, the sum of your assets need to be within a certain range, the risk needs to be minimum, you need to take into account different transaction costs. So there's a constraint on the problem, and it's obviously a utility maximization problem because you want to maximize the returns. It's an NP-complete problem, and there have been various papers published on how to solve this problem using dynamic programming and stuff like that. And central to the solution of this problem is the construction
of... I'm coming to a deeper understanding of...
Not me. Okay. Trying to find something.
Central to the solution of this problem is the construction of a covariance matrix, and this covariance matrix basically has the expected rates of returns of each asset and whatever you're investing. So this is basically the crux of the problem. You have an asset manager who wants to invest K dollars in a set of N assets with an investment horizon divided into T time steps. So basically the asset manager needs to decide how much to invest in each asset at each time step. And he needs to take into account the various constraints, as I said before, like the transaction costs and the behavior of the market. So what's the solution to the problem? The solution is that compute the portfolio that maximizes the return subject to a level of risk at each time step. So basically you have different time steps, and at one time step you think, okay, so the asset manager thinks, okay, so this investment is going to give me the maximum return. So that's what I'm going to do. The next time step will give you some other maximum return. So that's basically what I'm going to do. So now the problem with this is that this results in a series of statically optimal portfolios, which means that For one time step, what might be optimal might not be optimal for another time step. And if you want to rebalance your portfolio, there is a cost of rebalancing which needs to be taken into account. So this basically results in the formulation of a less optimal portfolio than the globally optimal portfolio. So basically, if you just statically rebalance, if you take into account the maximum return at each time step, you will not get the portfolio which is globally optimal. You might get something which is locally optimal, not globally optimal. So basically you have to, so the asset manager has to take that into account as well, which we'll see later on. So this was traditionally solved as continuous variable problems, but if you have large assets, which usually asset managers do, they don't have to deal with small assets, right? They have lots of assets which they need to invest. So for that, a discrete solution yields better results. So this is just the different symbols which will be used in the coming slides. I just gave them as a reference if people want to see the slides later on, because else they'll have to look it up in the paper. So this is basically the problem which we are going to run on the D-Wave. This is the integer formulation of the problem. So basically over here, So W is basically the holdings for each asset at each time step, which is the trading trajectory which we want to figure out. And this is basically the equation which we are which we want to run on the D-Wave. So the first term is the sum of returns at each time step. So the by the first term, we mean this, which is given by the forecast returns mu times the holdings w. The second term is the risk, and the third and fourth terms encapsulate transaction costs, which are a sort of constraint. Now, there were other equations related to the constraints, which I did not give in this presentation because it's not that much relevant to the quantum computing side. So, but they had to, the authors had to incorporate those into the DWeb as well. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about quantum annealing, which all of us know because of previous talks, but still a general overview. So it's quantum annealing is a way of using the intrinsic effects of quantum physics to solve mainly two types of problems. One of them is optimization problems, which is basically finding the best configuration amongst many possible configurations, like the traveling salesman problem. This can be mainly represented as an energy minimization problem. And the other type of problem which we can use quantum annealing to solve is probabilistic sampling, which is sort of related to optimization problems, but not exactly the same. So basically here, instead of finding minimum energy state, we sample many low energy states to characterize the shape of energy landscape. So this can be useful in machine learning, for example, if you want to build a model and you sample the energy landscape corresponding to the minimum energy state, and you get an idea of what the model looks like. So what is the use of quantum annealers? So quantum annealers are basically designed to solve certain problems using a quantum annealing algorithm that belongs to the adiabatic quantum model of computation. So what exactly the adiabatic quantum model of computation is will come in the next slide. And it's basically implemented in hardware that exploits quantum properties, like the D-Wave's quantum annealer. So this is a slide I took from Joel Gottlieb's talk. So this is basically the adiabatic quantum optimization perspective. So a system will remain in the ground state of all the instantaneous Hamiltonians passed through, provided the change is made sufficiently slowly. So as long as the change which is applied to the Hamiltonian is made sufficiently slowly, you can expect that it will be in the ground state. And that's basically the adiabatic quantum optimization perspective. So over here, this is basically the change, and this is the H is the Hamiltonian. So you want a final Hamiltonian to still be in the ground state. These are basically the steps for adiabatic quantum computation. So first you need to find a Hamiltonian whose ground state describes the solution to the problem of interest, which in our case is the optimal trading trajectory problem. Then then a system with a simple Hamiltonian is prepared and initialized to the ground state. After that, the simple Hamiltonian is adiabatically evolved to the desired complicated Hamiltonian, and then you get your result. So these are a few bits of information about the D-Wave's quantum annealer. It's a device which minimizes unconstrained binary quadratic functions. So basically, for this problem, we need to convert the integer. We need to formulate integer variables to binary value, convert them to binary variables. It's the quantum annealer is cooled to 15 millikelvin to keep disturbances at a minimum. They're shielded from RF signals, and they're shielded from external magnetic fields larger than one, that's nano Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tesla. And it operates in a high vacuum environment. So basically, they want to keep disturbances to a minimum to ensure that, for the quantum annealer to function properly, which is basically. So this is the application flow for D-Wave, which again I took from the Joel Gottlieb's talk. So first, you need to recast variables in original problem as binary variables. If you remember the equation we looked at, we need to to run it on the D-Wave, we need to recast those as binary variables. Then we need to convert the binary variables to the quadratic unconstrained binary optimization QBO. So basically, the QBO is the problem of minimizing a quadratic polynomial over binary variables. And then you need to solve the QBO using QBSolve, which is D-Wave's solver, which basically finds the minimum value of a large QBO problem by splitting it into pieces and solving it on either the D-Wave, or you can solve it classically as well on a classical computer. And then what you do is you convert the bit vector back to variables in the problem domain, and then you interpret QBSolve results and adjust accordingly. So that's basically how you would, a generic overview of how you would solve stuff on the D-Wave. So this is basically an example of a chimera graph, which is basically how to show the connectivity of qubits on the D-Wave and how you are supposed to embed qubits onto the D-Wave. So this is basically a sparsely connected graph with a well-defined structure of edges. Now the thing is that there is a limit to the size of the problem which you can embed onto the D-Wave. So basically that depends on like the on the size of the chimera graph as well, where it is basically on a chip with q qubits, you can, the size of the largest dense problem that can be embedded is root over 2q plus 1, which is 4s plus 1, where s is the number of unit cells along an edge. If you look at the previous graph, you can see that s is 4 over here. So basically the largest dense problem that can be represented, that can be embedded on a chimera graph is, in this case, it's in the previous case, is 70. So another problem that pops up is that if you want to solve problems that are denser than the chimera graph or the hardware graph, you need more qubits basically, which is a problem in most applications which you want to run on the D-Wave, because they usually are more dense than the chimera graph. So which results in you needing more qubits than the D-Wave has to offer, and as a result of which you can't run as large problems as you want on the D-Wave. So basically now I'm going to talk about how they converted those integer variables to binary languages. So the authors used four different types of encodings for the purpose. Number one is binary, which is a representation of symbols in a source alphabet by string of binary digits, which is basically like converting it into binary. Then they tried unary, which is representing a natural number n with n ones followed by a zero. Then they used sequential and partitioning. So basically, sequential is, I did not understand what sequential is, to be very honest with you. So I don't know what that is, sequential encoding, but they didn't use it in the results as anyway, because the sequential encoding needs too many variables to like convert the integer to the binary. So for that reason, they the size of the problem which could be solved on the D-Wave using sequential encoding was not too large, so it didn't make sense actually to solve it on the D-Wave. And then you have partitioning, which is basically find all partitions of K. K is like the maximum investment portfolio which you have, into N assets. N is a different number of assets you have. And assign a binary variable to each encoding at each time step. So these are the four different types of encodings which they tried. But in the paper, they've published results for just these two, binary and unary. So the number of variables required to, so this is about binary encoding. So there's a limit to the number of there's a number of variables required to represent a particular problem, and they're talking about this particular problem. So I don't know where they've come up with this number, but I guess they did some calculations and came up with this number, and they came up with numbers for all the four encodings. And the largest integer that can be represented is 2n-1. So basically there's a limit to the largest integer that can be represented because of the intrinsic noise of the quantum annealer. And so binary encoding is the most efficient in number of variables, efficient in the sense it requires the least number of variables, and it allows representation of the second lowest integer, so I said it's already efficient, and it's the most sensitive to noise, as in the intrinsic noise of the quantum annealer affects the binary encoding the most.
Can you just tell me quickly over here, T, N, K. So K was, again, the number of...
The whole investment portfolio, yeah.
The whole investment. And N was the number of...
assets.
Assets. T? I've completely forgotten.
Number of time steps.
Oh, right.
Okay, so for each time step, you're converting K into a binary, and then you have to do this over all N.
Yes.
That's basically what this is saying.
And they have this number of variables calculation for each encoding. Because, like, depending on the number of variables you're going to use, like, you need qubits according to that, right? If you have if you have more variables, then you need more qubits.
Well, that's a fully connected. So then you have to map it down, and you need proportionally more.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know actually what the factor is. That's part of what we'll see probably later on, how many qubits you need. I think there's a table, right?
Yeah, there's a table, but they didn't say how many qubits as such.
Oh, okay.
So the last two items here you'd expect to be connected. I mean, if you're going to use the least number of variables, you're going to expect that it's probably the most sensitive to noise.
Yes.
And compressed everything out of it.
Right. That's a good point.
So this is unary encoding. So basically, unary encoding does not is not affected by noise. So there is no limit on the largest integer which can be represented. But the problem is that it does bias the quantum annealer towards some solutions a bit because of different redundancy of code words for each value. So basically, the thing is that and it requires the second largest number of variables. But it requires the second largest number of variables, so it is a problem. So there's like sort of a trade-off. Like, do you want noise? Like, do you want less noise and the trade-offs between do you want less noise and do you want like more qubits or less qubits? So it's sort of a trade-off like that.
What do you mean by unary encoding is not affected by noise?
It's not affected by the image intrinsic noise.
Or not as much.
Yeah, not
probably
as, yeah, no, not like it, I shouldn't say not affected, but yeah. So, but that's what they said. Like,
so that's a property of the number encoding, and that you have more redundancy, I guess, because you're essentially flattening the number, the length or the number of bits that you're using is proportional to the magnitude of the number.
Yeah.
Can you say more about what it means to bias the quantum annealer, or how does this bias?
So. What they wrote in the paper is basically, so because of this redundancy, there are a few codings like sequential coding and that was unary coding, I think.
I was talking
about unary coding. Yeah. So there's unary coding and sequential coding. Basically, so because of redundancy in these encodings, they bias the quantum annealer towards a few solutions. Like, those solutions are more likely to come up.
I guess where's the redundancy? And it's just you've got a lot of ones there, or a lot of digits to represent.
I guess that's what they're talking about. Like,
but is that creating?
It could
a
be
field or something.
I think what might happen is you have two solutions, and if the two, or let's say you have three solutions, and two solutions are the same number of digits, then this will bias the overall solution towards them rather than the third one.
Well, the same number of digits means the same number.
In unary, that's right.
Yeah.
Or close together, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, once you get large, then the difference between them is going to be small, but or relative difference.
Yeah, so I guess it's about the distance. For example, if you did this for primes, then small numbers would be biased over large numbers because they're closer together.
Yeah. Puzzling.
It is.
So this is sequential encoding. So basically, in sequential encoding, the fact is that you will like get to represent the second largest integer and it's second most efficient in number of variables. So basically, since you can't either represent the largest integer or you're not the most efficient, so I guess that's why the authors have not included these results, used sequential encoding in their results when they reported the results. That's my conclusion. They haven't said anything in the paper. And the last encoding is partition encoding. So partition encoding is not one of your typical like encoding schemes. It is basically, as I said previously, you divide the assets into different partitions according to different time steps, and then you assign a binary variable to each time step. So that's basically what partition encoding is. It's the least efficient in number of variables. So that means that it requires the most number of variables, and the largest integer which you can represent is also not that much compared to the other ones. So here the authors have given a table of the number of binary variables which are used. So basically, VB is your binary encoding, VU is your unary, and VS is your sequential. So if you can see that over here, irrespective of like how many number of assets, time steps, or portfolio assets. Yeah, the total number of assets which you use, unary encoding will always require the maximum number of variables. And K dash over here is K by 3. So basically, they've used this K dash because like they're assuming that K dash is like the largest integer which they have to represent on the D wave, which for some reason I didn't understand, but yeah, that's what they've used over there. So irrespective of what the combination is, unary will always require the maximum number of variables. So over here, so basically now they've run this problem on the D wave's 512 qubit quantum annealer, and so I have two results over here. One of these is on the D-Wave's quantum 512 quantum qubit annealer, and this is also on the same quantum annealer, but the difference is that they've used a custom they've replaced the embedding solver of D-Wave with their own own custom built solver. So that's the basically the difference. They've designed this solver and they've used it on the D-Wave. And the thing is that they are getting better results when compared to like D-Wave's original solver. So basically, and how do you interpret results over here? So basically, let me just go from left to right. So you have N, which is the number of assets, T is the time steps, and K is like the total number of assets which you have. And they've used encoding is the type of encoding which you've used, and as you can see, they've only used unary or binary over here. Variables is the number of the number of variables which you need to have. Density is the density of the quadratic couplers. Qubits is the number of qubits which you need to represent the whole problem. The chain is the number of maximum physical qubits identified. And S over here is the success rate, which they've defined as like whether like the problem is actually being solved properly or not. It is not a speed up or anything of that sort. It's just basically, so they've compared they've run the same problem on like a classical computer using different algorithms, and they've they have this solution. And if your solution falls within a certain range, like if the quantum annealer solution falls within a certain range, then they consider it as a success. And I'll elaborate more on the success rate on the next slide, because there are a few more things about it. But the main takeaway from this slide is that their solver actually works better, because if you look, say you look at this column, which is like 263 of 263. So over here, if you look at 263, you get a success rate of 80, 100, and 100. But over here, you get 50, 97.50, and 99.50. So basically, their solver works better, which is like what they want to do.
This one's a longer table than
that. Yeah, this is a longer table.
Okay,
yeah.
I was thinking it was using more qubits than that, but then it's not. It's the same.
It's just the success rate, which is different.
So hang on a second. What is different is the embedder. So we also see, hang on a second again. The density in the original one, let's take again, this one was 0.28, so the density doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to indicate that since they have the same number of qubits and the same density, they are not really changing the couplings. They may change weights or so, but how is their embedding algorithm then affecting things if they have the same number of qubits and the same number of couplings? I'm a little surprised here.
Yeah. a good question.
And the other part is, are you going to talk about S0, S1, S2? What the difference between? Okay, good.
So, yeah, that's it. And so that was the 512 qubit quantum annealer. And here they've used the 1152 qubit quantum annealer with their own embedded solver. And it has a higher success rate than the 512 qubit quantum annealer. If you look at, so let me just pick one up at random, like three, if you consider 363, say. So over here, you have like 15, 59, and 78 as the success rate. Okay, so that doesn't even have
363. You know, in all these, they're trying to figure out, they're trying to just choose which is the best out of three portfolios. That's K, right?
Yeah. No, so N is the number of portfolios.
K is the number of assets that are in it?
Yeah.
Okay. But then, so you're only choosing between a couple very small numbers.
Yeah, it's really small.
It is.
They can't solve larger problems because they need more variables for that, and you need a bigger machine for that. So basically, the size of the problems which they're solving is really small.
And actually, looking at this, that was one of my earlier questions. When you see, compare the number of variables and the number of qubits that's required, you start with a factor of 3, and you go up to a factor of what is this? 6, 5.
Seven.
Yeah.
I wish they had a column for the product of N, T, K, T, and K.
Yeah. Yeah, that also.
How that compares to the qubits.
Like we can see that the number of qubits actually goes up in a
higher order.
Yeah, to some higher orders.
Well,
what that relationship is not clear.
If you look at the 253 line, its number of qubits goes down. Well, and actually the line about 233, their qubits go down from the previous one.
And that must be due to
you're doing more
time steps
because
of the more time steps.
Okay.
But I think it's also about the lower density.
Oh, yeah. So that affects the couplings, and if you have a lower density, it's easier to embed. That's true.
Yeah, but I guess one of the takeaways also from here is that the size of problems which you can solve is pretty, pretty small.
Okay.
Not even relevant to a real-life problem, to be very honest.
Well,
like
same was true of the first computer, digital computer.
Yeah, so as I said, the 1152 qubit quantum annealer has a higher success rate than the 512, because if you look at the success rates, their success rates are more than the previous one. So basically, over here, I'll talk a bit about what success rate basically is. So this is a solution metric basically. So the percentage of instances, so they've run this problem for multiple instances, like 200 or 100 instances. And so basically they're saying that the percentage of instances for each problem for which the quantum annealer's result fell within perturbation magnitude alpha of the optimal solution were used. So basically what I understood from perturbation magnitude is basically you start with a small with a simple system, and then you apply some change to it slowly. And you apply a small disturbance to the, you start with a simple system for which the mathematical solution is known, and you add an additional disturbance to the system. And if the disturbance is not too large, the various physical quantities associated with the perturbed system can be expressed as corrections to those of the simple system. So basically, you start with a simple system which you know, and then you apply some disturbance on it, and then the changes which are observed, using that you can I think measure the success rate, something like that, as much as I could understand. So they have said that basically they have their own range of optimal values which they got from the running the problem on the classical computer. And if the quantum annealer's result for that instance fell within the range of optimal values calculated, then it was deemed successful. And the S0, S1, and S2, which was there, was basically like the S alpha. So basically, if it's S0, then S0 is like, when it's S0, then the success is like finding the optimal solution. That's what it's defined as. So these are the problems which they basically face. So level, the intrinsic noise of the D-Wave's quantum annealer manifests as a misspecification error. And the coefficients of the problem that the quantum annealer actually solves differ from the problem coefficients by up to epsilon to the power 3, epsilon being the noise, noise of the D-Wave. So basically, if the the problem coefficients on the chip have a defined coefficient range, and if the specified problem has coefficients outside the range, the entire problem needs to be scaled down, which results in coefficients being smaller than epsilon, which is the noise, affecting the success rate. And this is like and for problems like the portfolio optimization, where small changes matter, this becomes a problem.
So what's epsilon here? I mean, is it greater than one or less than one? I mean,
it's just the noise of the quantum annealer.
I understand, but is it relative? I mean, the thing is, if epsilon's small, epsilon cubed is going to be really tiny. You know, that would not affect the accuracy much, but if it's, you know, 2 or 3 or 10, you know, then it's a big problem.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah. They haven't said anything about, like, the value of epsilon. Actually, they have a calculation for epsilon, so
that's it. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out whether it's a relative amount or a delta, you know, just a fixed difference or...
So they say over here, there's a level of intrinsic noise which manifests as a misspecification error. The coefficients of the problem that quantum annealer actually solves differ from the problem coefficients by up to epsilon.
And is it an additive or a multiplicative? Or?
And I think they're taking the difference between the two. That's all they're saying.
Oh, okay. So epsilon is some number and they're just adding it.
Yeah.
No, they are observing a difference between what the quantum annealer actually solves and what the specification originally was.
Oh, okay.
That's what it is. And forget about the power of 3. I told you that in the email that I sent you for the slides. It's just epsilon. It's just epsilon.
Oh, okay.
You can change that later on your slides.
Yeah, my bad.
Was it a footnote?
Yeah, it was. It was. He put it in there.
I was trying to figure it out. I never heard of it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't understand.
Very good.
So, another problem which they faced is that to solve problems that are denser than the chimera graph, you need multiple physical qubits that are identified with a single binary variable. So, basically, you need more qubits. And to force the identified qubits to all have the same value, a strong coupling is needed. And if you need more qubits, then more qubits would allow the use of an encoding scheme which is less sensitive to noise levels. And obviously better error correction is needed. So now at the end of the paper, they have a small paragraph about speedup. They were actually very reluctant to talk about speedup. So they've said that So they started, like, there's an ongoing debate on how to define quantum speed up, so there's no way to actually say whether, like, it's speeding up or not. But since we are comparing the classical with the quantum, we need to talk a little bit about speed up. So basically they're saying that for the small scale problem solved in this study, the time is comparable. Like, and to be very honest, like, the problems that they're solving are so small, it's difficult to understand whether there's a speed up or not. Because it's like 3 assets with like 4 time steps or something like that, which is a very small problem slice. So yeah, it is difficult, but yeah, so that's the thing. And they've said that basically only after quantum speedup has been demonstrated for general problems, and specifically those requiring a high precision of couplings, it is expected to observe quantum speedup for the optimal trading trajectory problem. So they said that basically wait and see, that's it. And so the conclusion is basically they've demonstrated the potential of D-Wave's quantum annealer to achieve high success rates while solving the portfolio optimization problem. So basically, the main takeaway from this paper can be that, okay, so we can solve problems like that on the quantum annealer. At this point, it's not like sure whether it's faster or not, but we are getting high success rates, which means that the problem is being solved correctly. So like that's a win if you can like think about it that way. And it's possible to achieve a considerable improvement in success rates by fine-tuning the operation of the quantum annealer. And technological improvements in future generations of quantum annealers are expected to provide the ability to solve larger problems and at higher success rates. So yeah, that's pretty much it.
I suppose they didn't say whether they lost or made money on
using this. Yeah. So this company basically does stuff like that. If you go to their website, they have lots of papers like like running this on the D-Wave, running that on the D-Wave, different problems like that. So I thought this would be like interesting because it's like relevant. It's like a real life problem, which like in the financial world. So it would be interesting to take a look at how they solve it on the D-Wave.
So it seems like there's a trade-off depending on how you represent the problem in terms of like size of the problem and noise and bias. Mm-hmm. There's like it seems like there's like a balancing sort of going on. So like I'm wondering, you know, these may not, there's four encodings that you talked about, but there might be more, and maybe there's a representation that's very succinct, mm-hmm. but the trade-off would be that it would be very noisy.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if there's like a good like balance, kind of that midpoint for noise and succinctness, and that'll help you represent your problems.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But yeah, that's a good point actually. But they didn't talk about anything like they did talk about the trade-off, but they didn't talk about the specific encodings. Like they did say that there was a trade-off, which mm-hmm. was evident. But they didn't talk about like which encoding would like be the best, like keep a balance. So yeah, that's something to think about.
So see, the other thing I'm wondering about is like real life application. So high speed trading, mm-hmm. all these firms have like insanely fast internet connections so they can get this data very quickly. So if you wanted to do this for real, assuming you had like a big enough quantum annealer,
mm-hmm.
they would have to like not only like take in this data, they'd have to like convert it into the quantum problem.
Yeah.
So there's also not just the sync-sickness noise, but you'd also have to consider like how fast can you
convert
the problem.
So that's the thing, when they talked about speed up, they said that the time is comparable, but they didn't say that what they measured basically. Like did they measure the time taken to convert it to like binary variables and then like run it on the D-Wave, or I don't know what they meant.
Just setting up the parameters on the quantum machine takes a long time.
Yeah. So,
but again, this could be a technology issue that can be reduced.
Uh-huh.
It cannot be eliminated, obviously, for physical reasons.
Well, and the other question is how frequently would you need to change those parameters? You know,
mm-hmm. Right.
You can't even like measure it accurately. I feel like the problem is that you can't even measure it in a reasonable way because you have to. Paper doesn't even say like if it's counting the time of conversion, which would be drastically larger than actually solving the problem.
No, they aren't talking about that, huh?
Yeah. If we're talking about like a real world application, then these are if you're just talking theory, I don't care. But
yeah,
if you're talking about application, I want to know these things.
Yeah.
Other comments?
So I mean from this talk also and from previous talk about the quantum machine language, becoming, at least at this point, a kind of picture is that you need a lot of qubits to see any kind of benefit.
Like a lot, like.
Yeah, I mean, so the number, I mean, and at least for the way they try to solve the problem is they're just taking a classical problem and trying to map it onto quantum bits, and I don't know, I mean, yeah,
But yeah, it just puts in the question, what is the scale of the qubits that you would need before we can actually get to solving a big enough problem to justify the use of quantum computing or not? I mean, yeah.
That's one question, yeah.
I mean, it's still early days, definitely.
Right.
But then, where are we going to? Is a qubit just becoming like a classical bit? And then, if that is the case, then why have a bit that can have multiple states if it cannot hold multiple states? I mean, more than two states at once. I mean, I just wonder about that.
So the more fundamental one is still the quantum supremacy in terms of complexity. If that is the case, then it's a matter of technology scaling. I think we've addressed the question that you've raised with the number of qubits. So there's no point in repeating it in the context of this. What might be interesting with that paper is, given an optimization problem, what are the steps you actually go through in order to map it to a quantum machine? And what are your options that you have? So, for example, different number representations, that's something that was unique in this paper that we hadn't actually considered before, and what are the effects of that?
I think it would be worthwhile to look at a few problems and see how they're mapping it down to the D-ray.
Yeah.
Because that would give us an idea as to how we can do that with a general set of problems.
Exactly. And to that extent, since you bring this up, there is actually material on our website that I set up when you look at the map coloring problem that not only has slides, but there is code that you can find associated with it, and you can go through there and see how the mapping actually works.
I think this was the second talk on how to solve a real life problem. Joel's talk was the first one, the traveling one, and this was the second one. So.
Yeah, and the third one I haven't really touched, but you can go through the slides yourself with the with a map coloring.
Any other questions?
Yes.
I still have something else, but go ahead.
Oh yeah, just so the maybe not a question, more like so the equation that you showed, that's like it was at the beginning was like integer quadratic programming basically.
Yeah.
So so this problem is NP complete. But I'm wondering, so like a lot of problems you could just do like, I'm wondering about how integer linear programming maps to the D-wave, because those are not, they have polynomial time algorithms to solve integer linear programming, and that might be something which maps pretty easily onto the D-wave. Not really a question, just a tangent of a thought.
So,
I mean, the fact that it has a polynomial time algorithm, would that
still get a polynomial speed up on a problem?
It's not a low polynomial. I mean, it's something, four through six power or something.
I would say the ILP solver is actually known to be terribly slow once you get to large number of constraints and variables involved.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. So usually, people don't even use the exact solution. When you're actually solving integer linear programming, you almost always use the simplex method. Because it's usually faster in practice anyway.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So